Pee Wee Herman was born in the late 1970s out of Paul Reubens' improv group The Groundlings as a character he thought in real life would never make it as a comic. Along with his friend, the late Phil Hartman, Paul Reubens developed the Pee Wee Herman show, placing Pee Wee inside a magical playhouse full of puppets and actors parodying children's TV shows. The show toured the country, sold out Carnegie Hall, and eventually became an Emmy Award-winning TV series.
Throughout the late 80s on Saturday morning, Pee Wee's Playhouse inspired countless generations with its puppetry and its subversive humor. After they decided to end the series, Reubens was arrested in his hometown of Sarasota, Florida, for masturbating in an adult theater. Although this sex scandal pales in comparison to the likes of today's Kardashians and Paris Hiltons, it launched a witch hunt into Reubens' life that kept him out of the public eye for years. It seemed like Pee Wee Herman would never come back.
Miracles do happen, and Pee Wee Herman is back! With a new HBO special of his new Broadway show and the promise of a new film directed by Judd Apatow.
Joining us is filmmaker Kirthi Fix. Her new documentary, Who Took the Bomb? La Tigra on Tour, focusing on the electroclash band La Tigra, premieres at South by Southwest.
How do people in the Riot Girl music scene overtake oppressive symbols by embracing them with sex and humor?
Kirthi's upcoming puppet film on the life of Christine Jorgensen.
And all the hot news, the lost city of Atlantis found.
An English vicar gets in hot water for dressing up in drag.
And the intense life of young internet tycoons. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Today's show is brought to you by generous support of fabulous listeners like you. Thank you. And by LifeLube.org, your gay, sexy, healthy spot on the net.
Gay men's health is about everything. Your body, your mind, and spirit.
LifeLube delivers daily news and commentary on gay men's health issues with wit, whimsy, hairy daddies, kooky queens, sparkly fairies, and Peter pointers.
Need health pointers? Ask Peter. Peter Pointers is LifeLube's gay health educator, assisted by specialists on call to answer your health questions.
Ask for Peter Pointers, visit LifeLube.org. Deconstructing popular culture like a military sergeant with his first year recruits. Attention, soldiers, it is the Feast of Fun. I am Fausto Fernos once again, joined by
I'm your general.
My general, Mark Fillion, and Lieutenant Officer Kirthi Fix joining
us.
Reporting for fun.
Attention! And Kirthi is here with us at South by Southwest, the Music and Media Conference, which really should be renamed I Meant to Go See That.
Or, hey, I got a big line for you. And you're going to wait in it. And well, maybe if you come to my hotel room, you can snort it too, but.
Whoa.
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
It's, you know, popular culture and the media and the internet, and there's all kinds of people, you know, especially publicists. Publicists love to do cocaine, I think. It goes hand in hand. Well, there we go. We just killed everybody, every guest on the show.
Your audience just went away.
They were like, oh, well, okay. So anyways, we are so excited. Today we are dedicating half of the show to Paul Reubens' iconic character that came from the 1970s, improv The Groundlings. It was his answer to create a stand-up comedian that cannot make the audience laugh. And Pee Wee Herman, decades later, influenced countless generations with his postmodern take, his childlike persona, bringing in puppets and all these wonderful, colorful characters. Certainly co-developed and co-written by Phil Hartman, rest in peace, from Saturday Night Live and The Simpsons. Best known for, you know, what was it, Phil Hartman's best character in The Simpsons? Hi, you might remember me from The Simpsons, but I don't remember my name.
Troy McClure. He had a thing for fish.
And he played Captain Carl. And so Paul Reubens for the last 10 years has kind of been laying low. He was in, I think, towards the early 90s, he was arrested in a movie theater in Sarasota, Florida.
His hometown.
His hometown. So he actually had a home.
Watching straight porn.
Watching straight porn. So you know more about this. Well, tell us
about this porn experience.
The only reason, because I was so curious, like, what is his story? Is he straight or gay? I wanted to know. And I read up on that and I was so shocked because I think he married the daughter of Doris Duke at the Shangri-La, like, it's in Hawaii, and it's this crazy, like, Muslim temple house, and they got married, and he had a longtime girlfriend, and I was like, really? I thought Paul Rubens was definitely gay. He just, like, there's so much homoerotic,
yeah,
you know, sub layer content. And so there was an undercover cop there, and because it was Paul Rubens, they really wanted to make an example
out of him.
Because he was like, come on, let me do community service. But he was doing a kids show, so they really nailed him.
They're like, no way.
And then he was caught, I shouldn't say, he was accused a few years ago of having child pornography, and they came in and confiscated. Apparently he collects a lot of like 50s and 60s cheesecake magazines, like, you know, those muscle magazines.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
With guys in their like posing straps.
Yeah.
Like pre-porn.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And because some of those models in that era were like 16, 17 years old and are technically underage, that's what they were trying to use as a pretext. But he's buying like boxes of things at auction. So he was like, I don't know what's in every box. I haven't even unpacked all that stuff. So
it was stuff he hadn't even seen. Well, you know,
they dropped the charges. Okay. It was totally unfounded.
But it was a witch hunt, and they went into his house. It was a witch hunt. And they tried to, like, they broke apart all his furniture. Yeah. You know, he's kind of like John Waters. He collects a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know,
he's
so
a hoarder. That's right.
Hoarder. He is a kind of a hoarder. And I mean, you know, his hoarder mentality, and you see that in the set of, you know, Pee-wee. Well, a lot of people don't realize Pee-wee was the director and the star of his own television show
for
many years.
But without hoarders of the spirit of John Waters or Paul Rubens, you would not have these amazing collections that, you know, hopefully they're, you know, the Museum of Sex, you know, they wouldn't have the stag films in their collection or
like Andy Warhol's collection of cookie jars. How many did he have? Like 2000, some crazy amount of number.
Well, and we really appreciate these kind of individuals who kind of create a mirror for our culture. And let me tell you, we went to see Paul Rubens, Pee-wee's movie that's coming to HBO next Sunday. The Pee-wee Herman Show. It's
on Broadway.
On Broadway. It's going to be airing
Saturday, March 19th.
March 19th. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you that every single person in that audience was like a child.
We laughed nonstop.
You know? And I really, for me, it was like, it's like that piece of candy that you've eaten a million times and you grew up and you stopped going trick-or-treating as a kid and then somebody buys it and you come home and you're like, it takes you all these wonderful memories of your childhood.
Well, it was twofold because you got to be in the child space, but as an adult, you got to laugh at the like sexual innuendo and that was like really subversive. So it plays on two levels. It's very witty that way.
And it was one laugh after another. It almost, you didn't have time to finish laughing from one joke. And then you're like, oh my God, I missed that joke because I'm still laughing.
He's sitting on Cherry. He's sitting on Cherry.
Did he never sit on her?
Yeah, he did in the TV show, sure. Okay. But when you're a kid, you're just like, he's sitting on Cherry. But when you're an adult, it's like, he's sitting on Cherry, you know?
So we're going to talk a lot about the HBO special now. So for the people who haven't seen it, who don't want the spoilers, skip the next 10 minutes of this podcast because you will be disappointed or something. So the first thing I want to talk about is the secret word. So I want to give it away. So please skip. But if you want to hear about it, listen to the next 10 minutes. The secret word was fun. And I was like, yay!
Well, how could it be anything but fun? I mean, what was it going to be? Lollipop?
Well, he had all sorts of secret words. You know, a lot of the words were like, for example, was one of the secret words. So he's like, I like that, Pee-wee.
And yeah, but it's hard to build a show around the word like, but you can build it around fun.
Well, and the whole premise of the whole
Feast of Light
thing is the computer is this like, you know, presence. The plot of the special is that he's getting his playhouse rewired for the internet.
To be modern.
To be modernized. As if, you know, as if that playhouse is out of space and out of time anyways. But and so all the puppets in the house are getting nervous, including
the robot. What's the
magic screen?
Magic screen is really
And they're
nervous.
All going like they're almost to the point they almost plan a mutiny. Which I thought would have been interesting to see them all like tie up Pee-wee and
I know,
turn
right?
the tables on him.
You're the puppet now.
But and so they're wiring and they're anxious and they bring out this computer and the computer is kind of scary, you know. It's kind of like
it's big. It looks like 1970s computer too. That's the hilarious thing. It's not modern at all. It's got like a huge like turning dial in the back.
But he's got a robot. That's modern. That's futuristic.
Well, but it's clunky. It's a robot that doesn't work perfectly.
It's futuristic if it's 1963.
Okay.
And actually, clunky is also a reference to like beatboxing and, you know, hip hop and breakdancing and the way he moves and stutters and his chest is built out of a boombox.
That's true.
And, I think that's your extrapolation. I don't think it's crunk related at all.
It is not crunk related.
I'm not talking about crunk. The clunky is definitely referencing, you know, hip hop and film like they built his chest out of a boombox and he's going pee wee, you know, the music of the 1980s.
Okay,
I got it.
Okay,
had
I
that
buy
kind
that.
Of
okay, mm-hmm. I'll buy that.
It was a reference to, you know, Max Headroom and that kind of like stuttering rapping style music and so Clunky was sort of making fun of that at the time. So in a way, Clunky references, you know, rap music of the 1980s. So like the Fat Boys and like, yeah, anyways. And so they're wiring the whole playhouse and the puppets almost take a mutiny and finally they bring out the computer and the computer like takes over like Pee-wee's mind. And so we'll let you discover what happens after that, but
you know what I thought was interesting that took a turn I didn't expect is that I don't remember in the TV show Pee-wee ever leaving the world of the playhouse, and in this he it's such a funny moment when he leaves and he runs out of the playhouse in despair because he doesn't get his wish answered and he's suddenly in the woods, the dark woods at night, and the dancing bear comes out and they break the third wall because he takes his bear head off and he's like, no, I'm just a dude, and Pee-wee's like,
just a bear.
Yeah, you can talk. I thought you couldn't talk.
Now, was the bear was not in the original show though?
No.
Was he?
And is it
no,
really funny?
I don't remember him.
But it is a reference to a lot of kids' shows that have these kind of like menacing people in bear suits.
Well, and then of course also Pedo Bear, which is the, you know, the
4chan a viral
meme
community
of the bear that kind of like that they use to represent things that are kind of like child pornography, like, or if you like it, like if you
they call it Pedo Bear.
Pedo Bear, and it's a bear. And it's like, we, you know, if you see something like, you know, a teenage boy that's being sexualized or a girl, like, you know, like how the Japanese anime kind of does that kind of stuff. And like sometimes people will put that little bear there to be like as a comment. So you don't have to say this looks like kiddie porn or this is like over sexualization. So it's like pedo bear.
Yeah, they say, let me read you the official word here. It's a cheerful mascot for making fun of creepy content or users' activity wanting to sexualize young people or children inappropriately. Mm-hmm. Because there is an appropriate way to sexualize young children.
Well, and so, you know, and Pee-wee is, you know, like supposed to be a little boy, really.
Yes.
And
yes.
So it's nice to see, though, Paul Rubens kind of become a distinguished older gentleman, you know. And so in the question and answer session that he had with really an audience of filmmakers and content creators, he was a very different person, wasn't he?
He seemed so happy and relaxed. Like he'd really come into himself. It was really reassuring, wasn't it? It was like, you deserve to be successful and beloved. You have affected so many of us with your wonderful subversive art. Mm-hmm.
And we all masturbate, you know?
In movie theaters.
So why not? And, you know, and especially now, Fausto, you got up and asked a question. You're like, why now? Why are you coming forward?
Well, my first question was, what are you looking, you know, you started this in the 1970s. I didn't want to remind him that you started this in 1978.
And audience, I just want you to know that it was like the first question practically.
It was the second question. I never ask the first question because then I look like a crazy person.
And Paul Rubens was like, uh-oh. Wow, you're so excited. excited, you know, Fausto's gesticulating.
Well, this is what I did.
He did an immediate follow-up, and Pee-wee Herman was like, well, just dance, ask as many questions as you want to, sir. It was really funny.
So the first thing was, you know, we wanted to cheer him on because this is his audience of his peers. And I said, welcome back, Pee-wee. That's the title of today's show. You know, we really feel like Pee-wee has kind of been like Jesus in the woods. Mm. And now as a society and as culture people, we need someone like Pee-wee Herman. Mm-hmm. We need that moment. And I thought, you know, it'd be interesting to see from his perspective, because he had taken off the Pee-wee costume, the persona, for 10 years at least, you know, and really like suffering with being persecuted by society and by the police. And it's like, what do you look forward to? What is going on through your mind when you're dressing up in this character that made your life, defined your career 20 years ago?
Well, and what was so interesting in the Q&A is he's in the outfit. Like he came to it's not like he has to be in the outfit to do a show. He's in his Pee-wee outfit, but he's speaking as Paul Rubens. And he seemed totally integrated, totally relaxed. Other times I've seen him in the outfit, he's doing the Pee-wee character and it's a little like, oh dude, do you ever like relax that? Mm-hmm. He seemed really.
And whenever we interview people that sort of walk that tightrope of, you know, am I my character? Am I, you know, like, Pam Ann, Aunt Bertha, Mason. I mean, we're always like, we want you.
Shirley Phelps.
She does not break character.
She does not. I had to stop listening to that show.
She's a rough girl.
Most of the way through and I was like, I can't listen to this woman anymore.
Believe me, I wanted to edit the show myself.
But, would she call you sweet? You're sweet such sweet dog. Little.
She blessed little. Us. Said, God loves Feast of Fun.
I know. I don't know if that's an endorsement or a punishment. But so my challenge as a person that does a talk show 5 days a week is that I want people to be their authentic selves. I want them to talk about what they do from their perspective, because I think they benefit the best. Because this is therapy for them. And because when it becomes therapeutic for the guest, it becomes therapeutic for the audience.
That's right.
All have a good time.
That's right.
And I've always wanted to see Paul Rubens be that person.
Yeah.
So to me, it was like seeing my childhood hero that was fallen, that had influenced me so much, come back triumphant.
Yes.
In a way that, and let me say, there's a lot of like nudge references and jokes against moral majorities, conservative Christians in this country.
But he does a very, very savvy thing. The show starts with the Pledge of Allegiance. Totally seriously, not sarcastic. The whole audience does it with him. And I thought, oh, that's so smart. Because then you like, it's like, oh, we can play this game. Oh yeah, we're patriotic. And then the chastity ring.
It's a promise ring.
I keep saying chastity.
And the funny thing about it is when he waves it back and forth to let you know it's his abstinence ring, he does like, he's like subtly jerking off motion with it.
And it has a little bling sparkle like that he did in post-production every time he does it.
I didn't catch the masturbating thing, but once you pointed it out, I was like, oh, it is? That's what it is.
There was lots of references to
And that
to
great story he told in the Q&A, someone asked, where did the Pee-wee dance come from? And he said, you know, I don't remember the joke, but my father used to do this off-color joke. Mm-hmm. And he said, I don't remember it, but the punchline was doing your thumb in your mouth and your thumb in your ass. Mm-hmm. And he was like, that's where the dance came from.
It was one after another. Yeah. The thing that I laughed about that, especially because my good friend Daria, her mother was like a second mom to me. We used to always laugh because she would tell us, like, you got to wash your hands. Because she would take her hand, put it by her mouth, and then she would put it by her ass, and she'd go, oral fecal. You don't want to contaminate. And so she was kind of doing like the Pee-wee dance. Like, we didn't realize it, you know? And so I can't wait to call up Daria. I got to tell her, like, the tequila dance is oral fecal.
Someone asked Pee-wee, Paul Rubens, have you ever bombed on stage? Mm-hmm. Like, you've done this character for decades. This is his response. I never bombed as Pee-wee because I could always mug. That character was born out of mugging. Everyone else was so much better at improv in the Groundlings. Mm-hmm. I had to do something that could rely on something other than coming up with funny material on the spot.
That's interesting, because I was really noticing it watching the film that his his sense for comic timing with his facial expressions. Mm-hmm. It's not so much his larger body physicality. It's definitely his facial expressions mm-hmm. they're just so funny.
He's like Jim Carrey. He stands in front of a mirror mm-hmm. and practices.
And we've all known little boys that make those kind of faces when they're perturbed or they're asking questions. I'm sorry, little boys and lesbians, I should we all know what they make those faces. Mm-hmm. They really do. And he does it very, very well.
Paul Rubens also address, like, you know, what is some of his secrets on how he has been able to have Pee-wee have longevity. And he said, well, you know, it's I have these hooks, these ideas that I pull out when I'm stuck. He says he got taught the audience one. He said, if you ever find yourself in a long, drawn out story, wait a beat and then say, you know, I love that story.
and then people always like, because I was like, where's this thing going? And you're like, oh, it's not going anywhere. But this person realized
we are going to use that on the show.
Oh, yeah.
I love that story.
Because I always feel that I'm like talking about something, and then all of a sudden I'm like in a corner. I'm like, I don't know how to get out of this.
Now,
but it's a great way to change it.
I'm a little confused because he also said that the Broadway show and the HBO special has the same director, the same people involved. As that worked on the CBS television series and the original HBO speech. What?
From the beginning, like from three, the very 30 beginning. Years ago.
Yeah, 30 years ago. So it's, you know, it's the same team of people. Obviously, Lawrence Fishburne couldn't, you know, come back as Cowboy Curtis. So they had somebody else, but they were able to bring Jambi, who forgot the guy's name. I have it right
and
here.
John
Yvonne. Paragon as Jambi and Lynn Marie Stewart as Miss Yvonne. And they look fantastic.
How old is Miss Yvonne now?
She's ancient. Wow. She's like 60 or something.
The most beautiful woman.
She's got like chicken skin under her arms. It was like, that was so funny because they're like, the most beautiful woman in the world, the most beautiful woman in the world. I love that.
Oh, absolutely. It's hysterical.
Do we feel like that Pee-wee has, you know, so much in movies and cultures when we try to do a reboot or try to bring back this lost glory, it just looks like a tired, exhausted old people.
It's because he's a writer. He writes his material. Mm. So he is, and he's just had like 20 years of downtime.
Well, in the show, like the plot was already nailed out 30 years ago. And so mm-hmm. he just kind of refreshed the material. So what did he say? It's like 20% old show and 80% new stuff.
I think it's like a fine wine, and it's so seldom you get to experience something like this. I'm sure if Sid and Marty Krofft rebooted H.R. Puff and stuff, it would be a disaster.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and think about all those childhood wonders mm-hmm. that we cherish and adore as adults.
Spider-Man on Broadway.
Yeah.
What, deadly. Is Julie Taymor out of that yet? I think she was trying to leave.
I heard scuttlebutt that she's a part investor, so I'm not sure they can kick her off the show, but I think they're delaying it for like 6 months. They're going to do a complete rewrite. And I think there's so much backlash against her version because she's trying to make it a feminist. It's not a feminist story. It's a story about...
She's trying to turn Spider-Man into a feminist polemic.
Mm-hmm. Really?
I didn't know that at all.
I didn't know
that's
either.
Why so many people are dying.
People in when there's aerial, people get injured. Yeah. Like Mary Poppins has aerial stuff. People get injured on that show. They mm-hmm. definitely had it out for her. And I think it's partly because
she's a woman.
No, I think it's because she fucked with, you know,
an iconic story.
The fanboy, you know, comic book hero in a way that wasn't, you know, what she did with Lion King was amazing, right? That show is mm-hmm. tremendous. That could have been the crappiest Disney, like the Disney animated film is super crappy, right? Did she use the Elton John music? Hardly at all. She got real African musicians to compose. It's beautiful puppetry, blah, blah, blah.
But
It reinvented puppetry. She's a genius. She's a brilliant production designer. And she's a good writer, but she took this, it's like she took something she didn't truly understand mm-hmm. and tried to manipulate it. And I think
not all things need to be reinvented too. You know, it's like I was telling these two hipster dudes, the only reboot I want to see about Spider-Man and Batman mm-hmm. is gay porn.
And that's pretty, you know, ambitious to do a musical on Spider-Man. I mean, who would have thought? I think it was possible.
Yeah. I don't think she's... I would not have hired Julie Taymor to do Spider-Man in a million years. I think that was a real misstep.
Okay. I mean, do you know like a, somebody who would have been better for that? Or do you know enough about Broadway for about that?
I would... I'd probably try to get somebody... Like even Tim Burton would be better. Even... well, the guy who did the movie.
Sam Raimi.
Yeah. Like,
have them direct a Broadway production.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Why not?
His reinterpretation, those Spider-Man films are great. I mean, I'm not a... It's not my shtick, but they're good.
Well, it's given us plenty of material through the month. So, Julie Taymor, we thank you.
And she's a fine artist. She's... I really feel for her in this time. I'm sure she's having a professional... probably the worst time of her life.
Well, it's kind of unusual to, for a show like this to be in this much pre-production too, isn't it? I mean, this, they've been going on it for over a...
I think
well over
long
a year.
Time. Long
I can't
time
verify this, but I think it's the most expensive Broadway production ever made. It's the Cleopatra of Broadway. You know, and for the at the time period, the Elizabeth
Taylor.
I'm like, South by Southwest took all my short-term memory, people. And long-term memory. Basically, I'm having a stroke right now. But Cleopatra, the film at its time period, was the most expensive because she, I think, had a...
She got sick.
She got sick. She was fighting with a co-star. There was like...
Nubian slaves, temples.
Had to be tamed. You know. So speaking of fantastic films that are just around the corner, you've been working now a year later on fantastic film about La Tigra, who took the bump, La Tigra on tour, and it's showing this Thursday if you live in Austin, Texas, at 6:15 at the Paramount Theater.
State Theater.
That's next to the Paramount Theater. Mm-hmm. But are they the same thing? Or is there,
I think they're managed by the same company, but they're two different theaters. The Paramount seats like 1,300 and the State is like 300.
And then if you're part of South by Southwest and you're attending it on inside the convention center Saturday at 2:30, and if you live in New York City, it's going to be at the MoMA, which is the Museum of Modern Art and probably breastfeeding. April 4th, MoMA. And, I mean, can people eventually, like, order the La Tigra DVD of this?
It'll do festivals and be a DVD and digital release. Oscilloscope is putting it out.
So. Now, is it mostly going to do queer festivals, or you think you'll just get
it's
into
done a mix. It's been booked. I'm going to Full Frame with it next month, and Hot Docs in Toronto. Mm. And, I probably shouldn't say that. It hasn't been announced yet, Hot Docs, but it will. Well, nobody cares.
Don't anyone care.
The Canadians are mostly pretty cool. They won't rat you out.
Yeah, don't rat me out.
Don't rat Kirthy out.
It's doing a ton of European festivals.
Yeah.
They're a lot of fans because the show, the film chronicles their 2004-2005 world tour that they were on for a year. So they're in Japan, Australia, New Zealand, London, Paris, you know, the U.S. So it's, yeah.
You were given the unenviable task of taking years of footage that the band had collected and created themselves. And
it's 1 year.
It was one year.
So, and some archival. There was some archival, but yeah.
Taking the footage and making a story out of it.
Yeah, they basically, Kathleen and I met through a mutual friend. I had produced a film called Who Does She Think She Is? And one of the experts in the film, Courtney Martin, is a wonderful writer. And she and Kathleen were on a panel. And she told Courtney, I'm looking for a documentarian. And Courtney's like, I have the perfect person. Meet Kirthy. So we met, and we have a lot of mutual friends, Gretchen Phillips and... you know, various people that we have in common. So we met for coffee.
Just to explain to the listeners, these are a lot of like important female musicians in alternative music in the 90s.
And if you don't know, Kathleen Hanna was sort of partly against her will, probably the poster girl for the Riot Girl movement. And Riot Girl was an early to mid 90s scene that was very important. Like Portland and New York and different places had a Riot Girl scene, and it was about reinventing feminism and making your own zines and starting your own band and really having a modern feminist identity. And, you know,
like Courtney Love.
No. Way no. No. These, you know, Courtney Love is one of those people. Her like her art, I think, is fundamentally feminist, but she's not a feminist.
Okay.
And Riot Girl was conscious, self-consciously feminist. And so they're trying
They were fighting for the liberation of women.
Well, they were reinventing the artistic expression of female identity. And they were making it hip and cool. And people like Kathleen was really a spokesperson, kind of against her will, because the Riot Girl ethos was really like, nobody is a spokesperson. They actually early on sort of made a consensus decision not to do interviews, and because they didn't want it to be commodified. So she was in a band called Bikini Kill, and she's very well spoken and funny. She's funny and charismatic. Mm-hmm. So her band Bikini Kill had a song called Rebel Girl, and just really great punk rock music. And so Kathleen, you know, fast forward, Riot Girl falls apart, horizontal oppression, people grow up, and she's living in New York. And one of her friends from the Riot Girl scene, Johanna Fateman, is living in New York, and they start fooling around with some of her ideas that she called it Julie Ruin at the time, electronic based ideas as opposed to punk rock guitar based ideas. And so when Kathleen and I met, she was like, you know, we have about, I think it was about 50 hours of tapes that we shot. We had our lighting guy, Carmine Cavelli, shoot footage on the tour. And do you think this could be a film? I'm like, I don't know. Let me look at the footage. So we captured all the footage. My intern at the time captured it. And I sort of looked through it, you know, pretty quickly. And I was like, I think...
Because it's got to be hard to just get something handed to you, because you've made films before, but you've actually directed them,
followed them, strategized the
shooting.
And so now here you have a bunch of footage and you've got to sort through it.
Yeah, and it wasn't, when you're shooting a documentary, if something happens, mm-hmm. you follow up. You shoot a scene after the scene that, you kind of want to have... You know when you're shooting that you want some through lines. Mm-hmm. And because, someone was, his real job was doing the lighting at their shows on this tour, he couldn't have that sort of focus. And so the live photography is like one camera, one position of the show. So that was the live footage. But they did have the recordings from the board. So we had really good sound mm-hmm. For that live stuff and some verite. So when I first saw the footage, I was like, this could be a DVD for fans, but I don't know if this is like a film. But to flesh out some of the ideas, I knew I wanted to shoot interviews. And I knew because there was so much music that, and we only had 10 weeks to cut it, I hired two editors, one Sarah Dvorkin, who cut my other film, Strange mm-hmm. Powers, about Stephen Merritt. And she did all the verite, and Paul Close cut all the music. So they were kind of working simultaneously. About 2 weeks into the edit, we shot interviews with Kathleen, Joe, and J.D. Sampson. And then once we put the interviews into the structure, it looked like a film because you put an interview mm-hmm. in there and it's like, oh, this. And then we screened for some people and they were like, it's a film. It's just a concert film. So that kind of helped us reframe. It is a film, but it's more a concert film. And we found when we described it that way, people weren't so uptight about like, you haven't told the whole complete story of La Tigra, and all its...
You didn't talk about how J.D. Sampson rose from the ranks from being a roadie to the front man for La Tigra, which is a feminist group, even though J.D. Sampson identifies as female, is gender queer. And then Sadie Benning, where is she now? Exactly. One thing I do really appreciate about all these musicians, and especially the Riot Girl philosophy or outlook, is that they want to take symbols or ideas of oppression and embrace them with humor. That liberation comes from laughing at some of the things that you have been scared of or hurt by. Mm-hmm. Look at the titles. Bikini Kill, right? So the bikini, burn the bra, but we're killing the bikini, not ourselves. And then there's the feminist sweepstakes. So it's like consumerism and then this like anti-consumerism idea. And then, of course, La Tigra, which is a word French for the pussy or the tiger. You know, the vagina is aggressive so much to the point that it's like a something to be feared, but it's French. So, you know, it's not that
inoffensive,
fearful.
Yeah.
It's le tigre.
Vagina dentata.
It's a fun little vagina that's going to bite you, nibble at your ears.
Like a kitten.
I mean, so was there ever a discussion on like how that kind of philosophy of like embracing things that hurt us or we're scared of or oppressed by and overcoming them by, you know, bringing them, sort of reenacting and laughing at them.
Well, that's the main narrative thread in the film, actually, is how they use humor and pranks to really undermine without being upset or angry oneself, but you can undermine the homophobic and sexist attitudes. Here they are, they're playing these huge rock shows with all these dude bands, you know, they're
huge
like...
huge names in music.
Yeah, and it's not... you know, it's not a gay friendly place. You know, you're going into clubs where there's like the super homophobic graffiti on the walls and the bathroom doesn't have a door, you know, it's that kind of crap. And they're like, they would pull these pranks and it's so funny. And they would flip the tables on these interviewers who are asking these really, you know, kind of sexist questions about, and just, you know, Kathleen knew Kurt Cobain, and there's a scene in the film where these New Zealand radio interviewers are like, yeah, so I heard the story that, you know, you're the source of Smells Like Teen Spirit, because she had graffiti, written that in graffiti on Kurt's wall. And in our interviews with them later, they say, and you know, the thing is that interviewer only cared about Kathleen in relationship to mm-hmm. Kurt Cobain. So her music and what she's doing and her humanity is not of interest, because what women do and what gay people do is, you know, queer. It's like it doesn't even register. So she flips it on them and she basically is like, oh yeah, we were graffitiing because we'd been spray painting at one of those clinics that, you know, persuades pregnant young girls they shouldn't have abortions, you know, and it's like the guy, you can see the guy's face just blanch.
Melting.
Yeah. That's not what he wanted at all. He wanted some salacious story about Kurt Cobain. And they're also like, he's like, oh, do you have tattoos? And she's like, yeah, I've got one of your face on my ass, you know, and it's just like they totally flip it. And it's through humor.
Well,
and
they will
wit.
Be invited back on that show.
Well, they do it in it's not mean spirited though.
They're playful.
They're playful.
So it's kind of like you get served, but you enjoy it.
That's right.
Like a good dominatrix. Walking on your back in heels, you'll be left with pain, but it feels so good.
It feels so good. They're super smart ladies, and the film is really funny, and it's really fun.
Did they basically write the lyrics to Smells Like Teen Spirit, or, I mean...
Kathleen, that's what she wrote on Kurt's wall. It was antiperspirant.
That's so fascinating. You know, I performed in drag at a karaoke bar in Olympia, Washington. Uh-huh. True story. Uh-huh. This woman comes up to me and she's like, beautiful old blonde lady. It was real sadness in her face. And she's like, you are so wonderful. You're so energetic. And she didn't sound like a Texas accent. I'm trying to be an old lady. Hang out with my mom. You remind me of my son. You know. And then she's like, he's not with us anymore. And so she walks away and they're like, oh my God, Kurt Cobain's mom loves you.
You're kidding.
I was like, what? Oh. What? Have I ever told you that story?
About 20 story? Times. I just pretend like I've
never heard it before.
I've let Kirthy react.
So basically, you know, endorsement by Kurt Cobain.
It was the first time. I enjoyed that.
We all, Kurt Cobain's music, we all wrote it. But no, I think, you know, an interesting article about that is that a lot of musicians, the idea of selling out, they compromise themselves when they try to reach a mainstream success. Kurt Cobain said about his music that it only got better when they actually sold out, that their Nevermind, that album, changed so much about how we think about music and angst and youth culture in the 90s. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that they work with some really good audio engineers that the record label was able to get for them.
Right.
And he said that he was sick of his first album. Do you think, like, in terms of La Tigre, with Sadie Benning leaving and J.D. Sampson sort of like taking the group in a new direction. Did something like that happen for them as well?
You know, I don't. Sadie Benning is well known as an artist and a filmmaker. And I think she's more a behind, you know, she's not a front person. And La Tigra, it's three people. It's not like they're playing a lot of instruments. It's they're doing electronic stuff. So it's like they're triggering sounds mm-hmm. and they're playing the keyboard and some guitar licks, but they're doing coordinated dance moves. And Sadie Benning wasn't such a great front person as much, but JD was. You know, I think she was brought on the tour because she was a friend of Sadie's and they needed someone to operate the slide projector. Because if you ever saw an early La Tigra show, they actually played here at UT in the, you know, that courtyard outside the student center that had the oak tree, has the oak trees. It's that little enclosed between yeah. the library and.
So they took over basically the space next to the library at the college campus of the University of Texas.
Yeah, it's
Austin.
A little enclosed space. They were on a little stage, but they had these like crude slide projections. They're in these jazzercise crazy costumes and they're doing these coordinated dance moves and the music's really fun and danceable. And I was just like, you know, all the like lady hipsters were there and we were all like, this is the funnest, coolest, because it makes art accessible. It doesn't say I'm trying to make the most slick, perfect thing. I'm having fun. Like I'm singing into my hairbrush, you know, in my room doing dance moves, you know, in my bedroom with my, you know, rock posters on the wall. And it was really endearing.
I'm declaring 2011 the year of fun. Man, this is like, you know, at this session, yeah. at this conference, over and over and over again. Why is our website successful? Why is this successful? Because we embrace fun.
Yeah, fun.
We are having a lot of fun. That was the most unfun way to say that. But.
Well, listen, you know, when everything's yeah. terrible, the economy's going to hell, wars and... This is all we have, each other. We just have our human connection and having a good time. Like, it's so simple.
Okay, Mark, make your Japanese earthquake joke now.
What Japanese earthquake joke?
You have been saying them over all day.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh!
Japan can't get away from what is it? Radiation poison?
Oh, that. I said Japan can't get away from nuclear disaster. It's just, you know.
I was just kind of reflecting on Godzilla is really mm-hmm. just kind of like a way of mythologizing earthquakes.
It is. Well, yeah, because they feel that earthquake. Well, you know, the thing is with the tsunami is like the tsunami is a Japanese word. So they're, you know, they know what it is. I'm looking at some art here your mother has hanging on the wall. And what is it? It's giant waves, you know.
It's that famous
Japanese
wave.
Art.
That yeah. wave.
Yeah. That people have tattooed on
yeah.
their back.
Yeah, there's yeah. several of them right
That's
behind
famous.
You, too.
Yeah.
So I don't. It's horrible. 10,000 people, I think, are estimated dead right now.
Our thoughts are with you, folks. Remember, just like Godzilla took down Mothra, you can overcome this. We are on your side.
I feel like I didn't answer your question about if La Tigra's music mm-hmm. changed when JD. And I just wanted yeah. to say that what JD Sampson brings to the band is an unusual queer sensibility, what she calls masculine femininity. And I think it was a shock to all of them, herself included, that she became really the sex symbol for the band.
Stud.
Total, like, sensitive, emotionally accessible stud. Because she's really kind of the, like, if Joe is sort of the steady oak, the, you know, she's the beat maker, and Kathleen is the charismatic, you know, singer. JD is like the heart. And, and her queer sensibility is so unique and so amazing that I think she really shifted them, and her sense of fun, and she's a really good dancer.
Well, when you say she, though, she presents as a male, though, when most people look at her. She's got a mustache.
You'd be like, is that a lady? I can't believe it.
She looks like a cute boy. She's a really foxy boy. So she's like...
He's a Valentino.
Trans.
But she's not trans,
like,
or no? No. She doesn't consider herself trans.
No.
She doesn't. Live,
but
as
she
a
could.
Man.
She's a lesbian.
She could okay. pass for trans. She could be
well,
like
most of the times I've seen her. She, you know, she's got a mustache on her, a beard or something.
Well, you know, I'm
like,
sure when she goes home at yeah. night, they go takes off that mustache, puts on a little lipstick.
Because I know, like, some of her videos have been posted on the website, and you know, people assume that when they see her,
who's that hot?
Yeah,
car?
I didn't know myself mm-hmm. what her situation was, and I think when I had some emails with Kathleen or Joe, I actually asked that. I was like, what pronoun? does Jay, and they kind of, I think, giggled a little bit that I was so clueless, but I just didn't know. And then when we interviewed her, she called it masculine femininity.
And that's the thing. If you don't know, ask.
Well, you're working on a controversial, your next project after this, not to get you to the future, but is you're making a fantasy film using puppetry and no human actors about the story of Christine Jorgensen, the first
famous transsexual. Yeah.
And so there was a lot of controversy originally because you did a stage reading of it. And talk a little bit about that controversy.
What was the controversy?
About that not having...
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a controversy, but I invited Kate Bornstein. Yeah, to the reading, and she left.
She was mad.
She was mad, and she wrote me a really helpful, long email, basically saying...
Or Z was mad, to be clear.
She wrote a long email saying why she was mad, that she was upset that we had cast a... genetic woman in the role of Christine. This is a staged reading, so the actors don't really look like the people. Like, you would never cast them in a movie, for instance. They just are good actors. And, you know, this actress did a beautiful rendition of Christine. That was our sole, you know, you're trying to sell the character as a character and the story. So, and it's really hard to get people to do, you know, stage readings because it's not a lot of money, blah, blah. So we took that. And when we did our next stage reading, because we did a rewrite and it doesn't matter. But the next one, we put out a call for trans actors, really looking hard for some trans actors to play Christine. Well, the problem is that most trans females are, you know, they would want a role that was a female role. They don't want to play a trans character because, you know, they want to be cast as a woman. And so we actually found someone.
A lot of them, you know, some of them do, but not all of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
We couldn't find anyone in New York. I'm sure they're out there. Mm-hmm. And if I had, $60 million budget Hollywood movie to cast, like, you could spend thousands of dollars searching the country for that perfect actress. But we had one friend who we auditioned, and she's involved in theater, and she's like totally beautiful and would be great, but she worked at a major company and she was like, she just backed out. And
she was not prepared to come forward as a transgendered person. You know, one thing we explained to people, the debate over the use of the word trans versus tranny really stems from wanting to pass and wanting to forget about your trans past, you know, your different gendered past, because you're working so hard to become this other person that's who you felt you've been all along, that you don't want to be reminded of that. And just like a lot of, you know, it's a difference between a noun and an adjective. So, like, you know, I think for a lot of gay men, they're comfortable with being called gay men, not a gay.
Right. Yeah. Well, the other thing too with trans women too is a lot of the idea for many of them is to pass. And once they pass, is they a lot of times leave kind of that gay queer world and they live a straight existence. And I think a lot of gay men, and why they might feel comfortable using the word tranny, is because, you know, they don't know somebody that would be offended by that because that person is living in a different community now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's like anything, any sort of difficult thing that happens to you. Like if you have cancer, do you want to be the cancer person all your life? No, you want to be a person.
For a while, you were the 9/11 lady on this show.
Survived the events of September 11th.
You know, now that you've made a documentary, now you're the magnetic fields lady.
Now that you're the documentary lady, are you getting like everyone with a band coming up to you and be like, Kirthy, will you make my band into a movie?
No, only one band in Sweden.
Really?
Yeah, came up to me. And
was their music any good?
No, no comment.
There was some band called Ace of Base. I was like, whatever. ABBA.
They sound like Lady Gaga.
So you're going to do this all with marionettes or puppets? They're puppets or marionettes?
I don't know yet what it's going to look like. We're going to build Christine in the next few months and do some test photography.
Wow. So just like the doctors in Denmark, you're going to build Christine.
I think why it works creatively is that, you know, it's looking at the construction of gender. Mm-hmm. Christine's situation, because it was 1949 and there was so little, you know, understanding just in terms of the health or sort of medical science around transgendered issues, she's really fighting an uphill battle because she's going to an endocrinologist and trying to get hormones in Denmark. And, you know, they were castrating men convicted of sodomy and rape in Denmark, and it was financed by the state. And they were also castrating them medically by giving them women's hormones so that their sex drive would go down. Oh. So there was funding for this hormone therapy. And so she persuaded through her friendship with this endocrinologist, Dr. Christian Homburger, she persuaded him to treat her with hormones. And she basically, her biographer thinks, Richard Doctor, who wrote her biography, that she had to write a letter saying she was homosexual, which she really didn't want to do. But that's how she persuaded the Danish government, because they paid for her whole thing. So
did they give her surgery? Mm-hmm. They paid for the surgery?
Well, it was a very, you know, the surgery was very crude at the time. Mm-hmm. She was castrated, and but they hadn't developed the medical surgery techniques around vaginoplasty. Mm-hmm. So it was actually in New Jersey, a doctor who specialized in it several years later, that she actually had a full vaginoplasty. There are actually photographs that only researchers can see at the Kinsey Institute where she went.
Now, have you been able to look at them or no?
No, you have to be affiliated with the university and be a researcher. Her biographer saw them. Mm-hmm. They took nude photographs of her, and they did a full interviews with her about her sexuality and her desires.
Now, she made a huge splash when she came back. You were telling me that because
it was 1952
when she landed here in America, and there's famous footage of her getting off the plane. It was the
53. Yeah.
It was the atomic age, and anything was possible.
She was the most written about woman of 1953.
Because people felt that medical science had transformed a man overnight into a woman. Not someone with like plastic surgery to look like a woman, but genetically able to have babies, breastfeed a woman in every sense of the word.
Yeah, the medical historian David Serlin wrote a wonderful essay that heavily influenced my interest in Christine Jorgensen, and he talks about what happens in the first 6 months of her being outed, basically. So when she first comes back, America is like, wow, science can do anything. She's a woman. And then her Danish doctor, Christian Homburger, released his full medical report on what was done. And in Denmark, they use the term, what's the term?
Schlong.
No, it's a
Wiener Schnitzel.
What's the word for a crossdresser?
Transvestite.
Yes, he called it transvestism, and
which was illegal in America at the time.
In America, that term was considered a perversion. Mm-hmm. It was a pejorative term. For him, it was a medical term, and there was a sort of translation misunderstanding. And then reporters start attacking her because she wanted to be a documentarian, and she showed her documentary of Denmark at the Orpheum Theater in L.A., and it totally bombs because everyone's like, we don't care about Denmark, what's your story? So she developed a cabaret act. So she's going around performing, and there's reporters, and they would ask her. They started getting really sort of more attacking her in their strategy, and like, are you a real woman if you can't have children? You know, the fact that she didn't have a uterus and could have children, like, what did people think? Like, did they think that medical science had, you know, crafted a uterus? Like, there was a naivete in the 50s that she really kind of cracked open. She used to say, I didn't start the sexual revolution, but I gave it a swift kick in the pants. And she really was one of those pioneers who
Actress Alison Arngrim, who played Nellie Olson, her parents were friends with Christine Jorgensen.
That's right.
And when she met Christine Jorgensen as a young girl, they said it's like she thought that anything was possible, that she could go to the doctor tomorrow and become a deer. Mm-hmm. And then,
or a fire truck.
A fire truck. Anything, get it like a physical manifestation to some other entity.
Well, and part of that is because Christine, you know, as in her male body, she was a 98 pound, you know, GI mm-hmm. at Fort Dix in New Jersey during World War II. She was a tiny person. She really looked feminine. And once she, you know, was, you know, public about being female, she looked really attractive and elegant. She dressed well. She mm-hmm. did beautiful hair and makeup.
She kind of looked like Doris Day a little
bit. She did, yeah. And she had a kind of Grace Kelly elegance. And she was really clumsy at first in that 6 month period where people kind of turn on her. Mm-hmm. She's really clumsy dealing with the press. But within the first couple years, she develops this language around transsexuality that has actually is what people are reacting to in the 80s. You know, she developed that whole language around, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, which had never been articulated before, and helped sort of persuade, you know, 50s America that this was a health problem, that, you know, it's like having polio. You know, you treat polio, you don't let it go untreated, mm-hmm. so you would treat transsexuality. And so she really helped create that language that made transsexuality understandable to middle-class America. So in the 80s, when transsexual people are fighting this, you know, this gender, this
gender roles.
Duality, mm-hmm. you know, there's one, you're either male or female. They're really sort of advancing Christine's message. Hers was more simplistic because of the era. And I sometimes wonder if she had been born, you know, in our era, would she have actually had the surgery? You know, like, or would she?
Would she have been more comfortable as a man, like an effeminate man? Is what she,
I don't know. I just think there would be more possibilities right. for her gender, whatever it is. But mm-hmm. I would just be curious, like, if she would have made that choice. I don't know.
Like when we interviewed Farron, the lesbian, the Johnny Cash of lesbian folk music.
I know Farron.
Farron, we asked her about, like, you know, where have all the butches gone?
You know, she's kind of butch.
And she said, mm-hmm. if I was been born today, I would probably be a trans guy.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. so in a lot of ways, you know, we are, you know, I know Lady Gaga's saying, baby, I was born this way, but I think it's also important to fight for the idea that you can be anybody that you want to be. You can love whomever you will.
So what's the scope of your story then? Does it focus just around the surgery and coming back to America and her celebrity, or how far does it go?
It is mainly the years between, we get a little bit into her, she was born and raised in the Bronx, and we start out with her backstory. Her family was very loving, and it follows her to Denmark. The transition, she's outed to the press, she falls in love with a reporter, and they have this love-hate relationship, which we sort of fabricate from some various stories. And then she sort of discovers herself and finds herself and accepts herself as a cabaret artist and being funny and self-deprecating and as a, you know, a pioneer of transsexual rights, basically.
Kirthy, your films are like LGBT up the wazoo.
I'm queer.
You are so queer.
I'm a queer straight lady.
Well,
I have some more queer news.
But I just want to say, it's like, what? So this is a pretty ambitious film, and it is a sort of a, you know, well-funded major motion picture.
No, it's not well-funded.
Well, I mean, you're raising funding to make it well-funded. You know, you're not going to do this on a dime-store budget.
It's not made for $5.
Yeah, it's not like a student film.
It'll be expensive, but it won't be like a Hollywood film. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so you're developing this film, and it's going to be finished in about next couple of years. And do you have a working title for it now?
Or? The Most Famous Woman in the World.
I was hoping it would be A Girl's Life. I just wanted to throw that joke in. But a little E.T. reference there for people who are, you know, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg fans will get it. Google that. A Boy's Life. Google that. So, you know, we're in the middle of South by Southwest. So many things are happening and everybody's like gossiping about the internet. Christopher Mootpool, who, you know, the internet is really a story, unfortunately, I think, for these young men and also for a lot of entrepreneurs, the story of these young, very hardworking, talented men who've become billionaires overnight by developing these websites. You know, best known as Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, the social network.
Heard of that.
You heard of that. You know about WordPress. The site is that you listen to is powered in part by WordPress. And
are the people who created WordPress millionaires?
They're very comfortable.
What's the revenue?
WordPress is a very well-off company. Most of its income comes from the fact that hosts sites like and helps sustain sites like CNN.com.
Oh.
So yeah, basically if it's a blog, it's being run on WordPress. Mm-hmm. And if it's optimized for large, massive audiences, WordPress has something to do with it.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Automatic.
You have to pay to get the upgrade.
Yeah.
You got to pay people if you want to play.
Oh, that makes sense.
And, you know, or you can do what we do and you know, you pay other ways. But, you know, there's many solutions and WordPress is a system of blogging and now content management system that was developed by a young man, whose name is escaping me right now, but
which one are you talking about?
The founder of WordPress.
Oh, Mullenweg.
Matt. Yes, Matt Mullenweg.
He looks pretty good in that photo.
He's really cute. He's like Jim Henson. He's a musician who is creating this open source platform in his parents' basement in Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. And when we first started blogging and podcasting, people were like, don't use WordPress. It's created by this young whippersnapper and it's not going anywhere.
Use movable type.
And movable type's dead. And history is the making. So he, you know, is, I feel like a bit overwhelmed about the platform that he's in. And then today they had a session with Christopher Mootpool, the founder of 4chan, which is one of the internet's largest online communities that really helps determine and fuel a lot of internet phenomena. Most famously right now, a lot of the members under the name Anonymous created sort of an internet vigilante group to bring about attacks on credit card companies and PayPal for suspending and cutting off funding for WikiLeaks. So, you know, these young men are really sort of like in the heart and the eye of the hurricane that is the rapidly changing world that we live in. And I think that maybe they might be a little bit overwhelmed, that it might be like intense. And today, Christopher Poole is standing there on the stage in front of, the entire conference.
Because it was like simulcast to everyone.
And the poor guy is about to like pass out.
He's so nervous.
He's like, good night. Some water. Oh, nice lady.
He got through it. He got Clavin.
And he's like banging his microphone. And it's like, it was.
But he's kind of cute. He's a redhead. He's young and
total firebush.
And I'm going to guess his wrist was a little limp. So I'm going to have to guess that he's playing for our team.
Yeah.
Really?
I think
guessing,
so.
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting, you know, geek and gay.
It's hard to tell the difference sometimes.
Yeah, we share a common thing. So I've been going around the conference and going to all these like geek hunks and taking pictures of them. So I'm going to create a photo gallery on our website, feastoffun.com, at the end of the conference.
Gunks.
I don't know. That sounds awful.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Geek hunks. Yes.
Geeks.
And how many of these guys that you took photos of, how many of them know, like, that's why you took the
picture? I said that to them. I said, I'm taking pictures of attractive guys at South by Southwest.
And they're like, ooh.
And most of them are very flattered. You know, for those gay men who don't feel comfortable approaching somebody, art and blogging is a wonderful icebreaker. And you might, you know, discover somebody who's just, you know, there's no sweeter meat than virgin meat. You might get your first boyfriend by breaking that wall and say, you know, hey, let's talk about something we share in common, like Tron or
your dick in my mouth.
Star Trek. We both love Star Trek.
That's how Mark and I came together.
Star Trek?
No, Earth Final Conflict, which was created by Gene Roddenberry with the gay aliens. Yes. And, you know, that which, it
were
was.
Were you
a,
dressed as characters and you had sex in a gay
We had sex
bathroom.
And then we started talking about it. He just brought it up and I said, that's my favorite TV show. And it was
because he had all this stuff, I'm like, do you watch this TV show?
And what's interesting is that that show was portrayed by two female flamenco dancers from Canada that were voice was pitch shifted and they were like in bald caps.
What are you talking about?
Earth Final Conflict was aliens. The aliens were portrayed by female flamenco dancers whose voices were pitch shifted. Yes.
No, there's a TV show called Earth Final Conflict. It ran for a couple of years.
It was developed syndicated by Gene Roddenberry, and it was a syndicated show like Xena.
It was
the theme
was these aliens came down.
Thank you for reference. I can understand, Fausto.
It was aliens that came down to Earth, and they were here, and they were kind of like asexual. You didn't know what they were.
And part of the focus of the plot was that they were had lost their with their technology. They had lost their ability to breed. Mm-hmm. And so they were doing experiments with humanity to try to figure out how to reignite the birth cycle of their species. Mm-hmm.
Would they break into like crazy dances?
They would walk kind of like flamenco dancers. And they were also on platforms too, so they had this weird hippie swagger.
Their toes are turned out.
And they talk very strange. They kind of talk like Eartha Kitt in a way. You know?
And then you don't know what's going on. There's two of them are fighting. And then it was, you know, because you're also like, what is their relationship to each other? And then the one turns on him and he's like, I hate you, mother. And you're like, what?
I feel a musical stage parody coming on.
Absolutely.
Fausto and Mark.
The Roddenberry experience. No. I know who I want to play Dawn.
Who?
Me or you?
I think Peaches Christ would be.
Oh, cool. Peaches Christ.
Because she kind of looks like Dawn.
Oh, I love it.
She does.
And who would be the other one?
Huh? I don't know who would be the little... you could
the
play
little monkey.
That'd be you.
Little monkey.
Oh, thanks. I think you could. Little town. It's a... No, little planet. They call it Earth. So anyways, what else is happening in the news? We got to wrap up.
Okay, we're
going to
wrap it up. Well, listen, I want to tell you about, speaking of some trans stuff and drag, there's a vicar in the UK who's gay, and he got in trouble because he dressed up like a whore for a party. But the title of the party was called Vickers and Tarts was the night title of it. And so why would, you know, what would you expect him to come dressed up as? As a vicar? Doesn't make any sense. So they've removed him from one church, and maybe he'll get a job someplace else, but I imagine it's probably going to be some very liberal church in London.
You know, I might consider visiting that church if the priest was in.
They should have like
a
church of drag.
I would so be at this church. Oh no, my God. I would too if the vicar dressed like this. What a sense of humor.
It was a fundraising party that they were having. They raised several hundred pounds, but the church won't take the money now because they said it's tainted.
Those bitches need to get a life.
I know.
But, you know, really, it's like fun is very radical in a lot of ways.
Why weren't they mad at this nun? There's like a whore nun.
She's wearing
here.
A pump.
What the
they're
hell?
Mad at all of them.
Oh my God. Okay. All right.
I guess they're all going to hell.
But, you know, fun is very subversive in a lot of ways because it's about taking the things that we think are true and establish and poking gentle fun at them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and when we're able to laugh at the status quo and the facts that we have, then maybe we can also examine it with fresh eyes and say, you know, maybe 400 people shouldn't own, you know, 60% of all the wealth in this country.
That's true.
Maybe the oil companies shouldn't be controlling our lives as much as they do.
And then also, too, they found, again, hopefully for the last time, the lost city of Atlantis. Can you guess where it is?
Jersey.
Detroit.
No. No, they think it's actually 60 miles north of the town of Cadiz in Spain. So it's actually 60 miles inland. And what they think happened is a tsunami came in and rolled along this low-lying coast and flooded this town because they've been able to find like these concentric circles, almost like crop circles of like buildings and a swamp. And this area is now a swamp. So they think that it's like it got flooded. And the reason that they think it's Atlantis is because they think people survived and they'll find in like on other areas around there, other towns, images of these concentric circles. Isn't that strange? So it's going to be on the National Geographic Channel on Friday. And you can find out more about it.
Did they find Jabberjaw's skeleton? That's what I want to know.
was he from Atlantis?
Yeah, they were. I don't remember. Hanna-Barbera cartoon set in 1970s in the world, in the fictional world of Atlantis.
Listen, I want
to... With a talking, walking shark.
I want to remind people, too, we can't do the show without your support. So please visit feastoffun.com and donate and give us a little cash.
If I lock this show, then you will share the button. Hit the share and save button. No relationship to Cher Bono. Mm-hmm. Or what is her real name? It's Cher. No, it's no longer Bono, though. Well, she has a last name.
It's some kind of crazy...
Her maiden name.
Yeah.
It's Cher. Some kind of, like, long Armenian name.
Wikipedia to the rescue.
And I want to
Sherilyn Sarkissian.
Sarcastic.
Sherilyn Sarkissian. That's her real name. Well, did you know? She had
I didn't know that.
What if that's on the checks?
Sherilyn Sarkissian.
Share Inc.
Share Inc.
So we want you to share the show with your friends because without your sharing abilities, they will not know how fabulous Kirthy Fix films are.
And today's show is also brought to you by our delightful friends at LifeLube.org, your gay, sexy, healthy spot on the net. Need health pointers? Ask Peter.
Peter, how do I know my boyfriend is good for me? Where do I find a gay-friendly church that I can get HIV testing in?
All sorts of questions to ask.
How likely am I to get HIV from oral sex? And, you know, I want people to think about conundrums. Like Stump Peter.
Stump Peter.
Visit lifelube.org and ask Peter Pointers your health questions. Gay, sexy, healthy. Visit lifelube.org. And Kirthy Fix, it's always a delight.
Such a pleasure to be here. I enjoy listening to the show so much. Thank you for
good work.
I have some good news I'm going to share with you afterwards, too.
Really?
Yeah.
You're going to make sweet love to me.
I'm not, but I'm going to. It's good news.
It is. Yeah. I got good news. Lady Gaga and Target no longer partnering together.
Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't really sort of.
We talked about it the other day. Yeah. Because we said to all the people that criticized us for complaining about the deal that Lady Gaga made with Target, we said, fuck you. We were right.
I was right.
You were right. Say that again.
Yeah. Say it again one more time.
We were right. So yeah, fuck you.
That's a basic. Basically, this is like the way the evening news should. This is how Rachel Maddow should end her show.
Totally.
Well, I just have to tell you because they're so consumerist driven. They're just like so ready to embrace that store for any reason.
It's okay to be consumerist driven. Mm-hmm. This is what we're fighting for. It's just to be able to kick back. Mm-hmm. Life is so hard, and you want to just be able to tune out sometimes. Open up that iPad and watch your favorite videos.
The way the people that embraced this deal, they were just so, like, they were just, like, jumping up for joy about it. And it was just kind of like, it's, look, they're still giving $150 million to all these anti-gay people.
And really, it's, you know what? I salute Lady Gaga for doing that. At the same time, I want to also be a person that supports, if you're a pop star and you want to make crazy, insane amounts of money and have your little, you know, ranch with your sex slaves lying around with palm fronds.
Slaves don't lie around. They're chained up.
More power to you, you know, but at the same time, as a consumer and as a savvy person, I'm not going to support companies that are so aggressively against the well-being of not just LGBT people, but of every American citizen. Mm-hmm. I mean, the precedents that Target set up and what's happening in Wisconsin, this should keep people alive at night, you know, awake, alive all the time, but awake at night. And really, you know, and it's a cause for concern. And I salute Lady Gaga for taking a huge financial hit.
I do too. It's a brave, it's a really brave act on her part.
Because other companies are not going to also, it's not just the money that she's lost through Target. It's also that other companies are going to look at the House of Gaga and say, we can't mess with this
person. She's a financial risk.
Well, she
breaks her contracts.
Well, so they're also going to come at her and say, like, if you have a good record and say, you know what, we have a good record. We can deal with this person. This person's popular. We're not out giving money to anti-gay forces. You know, so you can do that.
But sometimes, you know, it just feels sometimes like the CEOs of all these corporations got some, like, newsletter in the mail that said, fuck everyone. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm looking forward to...
I think that was in the Christmas Carol of Dickens. So 150 years ago.
But it just seems like they're more out of the closet lately. And I want them to, you know, sometimes certain things should go back in the closet. Like your hate, your contempt for mankind, you know. So Kirthy, leave us here with some fabulous music from La Tigra, which translates to English. the big pussy or the tiger.
Le tigre, tigre, burning bright.
What do you want to play? Decepticon?
Yeah, let's listen to the Decepticon.
Or TKO?
Let's listen to Decepticon. Okay. That's a good one.
That's a great one. This one, yeah, Paul Close's fine music editing on this song is featured on YouTube and Pitchfork, so you can do a Google search for that.
Fierce. Shout out to your, he's your partner.
Partner in life, girls. You should put that video on the fan page.
We'll do it right now. Yeah. We want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Miss Vix.
Thank you. It's always a treat. Thanks,
Mark. Always a pleasure, especially in Texas.
Oh, I love you, boys. It's like coming home.
I love it. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for listening to the show, people. I'm Fausto Fornos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.